Thanks for tuning in to KDNK. This is a Living Permaculture Show. I'm Stephanie Sison, here with Jerome Osentowski. Happy rainy Wednesday. I think that we're all excited about the rain that's happening right now, and hopefully we're out dancing in it. But really to remember that we're still in an extreme drought here that covers over a third of Colorado. In mid-May, the Colorado River saw some of its lowest peak flows in recorded history, according to the Colorado River District. So in the interest of water, we've invited our dear friend and water specialist, Avery Ellis, here. Welcome back, Avery, to the show. You've been on with us a few times before, and we're happy to have you here again.
Thanks for having me.
Our pleasure. And so before we get into the subject of today's show and really diving into water and your time here with us, I'd love to hear what you're doing right now. I know you're in the middle of an exciting permaculture action day there on the Front Range. So it would be awesome to share with our listeners what you're up to.
Sure. I'm here on the Front Range. I live in Boulder. And as part of the Boulder Permaculture Design Course, we had a really exciting Permaculture Action Day in July, building a cob bench in a trailer home park as a place for people to gather and kids to play. And so we're here today with about five or six folks mixing up another batch of cob and giving this bench some shape and some sculpture so that we can revisit it next month and give it a final lime coat and make it waterproof. And then the community will enjoy it for many years to come.
Excellent. And how often do these permaculture action kind of sessions go on up there?
Yeah, you know, it depends on the community. You know, here on the Front Range, we've had a really strong turnout of local folks who are excited to learn and get engaged. And so we've probably had about five or six big permaculture action days this summer. But I want to say, you know, up in the Roaring Fork Valley, there's a lot of folks that would be excited to get engaged. And I think that you could definitely activate that local community to get some local projects done, similar to your food forest, Stephanie, in Basalt.
And right. We actually had an action day on Monday with you doing the free gray water system. So that was sort of an action day. We hosted you after the academy, the Forest Garden Academy, and we had about all of the people from the academy, plus about four or five people from the Front Range, and we installed a gray water system.
That's right. That's right.
Yeah. Awesome. Well, on that note, you were just here for a few days up at the Permaculture Institute and also visiting out at Sustainable Settings, which was great to have you bring the rain with you. But we'd love to hear what you were teaching up at Crimpy for folks maybe who didn't catch on or hear about those workshops. What were you up to up there?
Yeah, so I was up at the Permaculture Institute sharing about water systems. We had a module in the Permaculture Academy about forest gardening, so how you might plant a garden to mimic a forest. And in my mind, you know, the first thing you need to do in planting a forest garden is you need to plant the rain. If you design a system where the rain is going to sink into your garden, you're almost guaranteed to have success in the future when you're ready to plant your plants.
Right. So you see that as one of the first steps.
And that was
absolutely.
That was either with swaling or with catching water off the roof or using gray water. So all three of those are techniques that you taught during the academy and during the gray water workshop. To harvest the water that people don't generally harvest. And there are laws out there allowing us to do that now, and we're going to talk about that.
That's right. That's right. So just like Jerome said, you know, shaping the earth to catch the water so that when you get your plants in the ground, they're going to be successful. And that could be swales, that could be rain gardens, that could be rain barrels, and that could be gray water systems. They're all really robust systems for getting water to your plants.
Well, I know we've talked about this on previous shows, but Jerome really wanted to make sure we brought it up on this one. Can you update folks as to your work in gray water and rainwater catchment and what the current legislation allows for folks to work with?
Sure. Let me give a quick little background. In 2013, Governor Hickenlooper passed the Colorado Water Plan, which included a lot of different methods for conserving and getting water where it's needed, both to agriculture communities as well as urban communities, and conserving water for, you know, habitat. And so along with that water plan, there was a law written that allowed for gray water systems in the state of Colorado. And I was a stakeholder in the development of that law since 2013. And we now have a statewide law called Regulation 86 that allows for gray water systems. For residential homes, you could use gray water to water your, to irrigate your landscape or to flush your toilet, which is, you know, both excellent opportunities to reuse water. And so that law was passed in 2015. The only problem is very few local areas have adopted that law, and it's up to our local jurisdictions to adopt it or not. I know that Pitkin County, which is where Aspen is, they did adopt the gray water rule, but they have yet to have anybody actually apply for a permit. So, you know, it's hard to get the updates on where this law stands, but those of you guys in Pitkin County, gray water systems are legal. Your local jurisdiction allows it. You just need to apply to your local building department to actually get a permit to build these systems. And those of you not in Pitkin County, I still encourage you to design and build systems and, you know, demand your local jurisdiction. If it's Eagle County, Delta County, wherever you are on the, you know, Roaring Fork or North Fork Valley, you know, we need people to be building these systems that are going to build resilience in their landscape and then demanding that their local jurisdiction adopts these common sense laws.
And what would a gray water system look like to someone who, I know we're on the air, so it's a little hard visually, but what does it look like to install a gray water system, or what does kind of the information they need to provide to apply for a permit, what does that look like, or where can they find that information?
Sure, you know, that's a good question, and it, you know, the challenge is that it varies by each local city or county. But with all that in mind, gray water systems are simple. If anyone's ever looked behind their laundry machine, there's just a hose that goes from your washing machine into the sewer. And it's really easy to take that hose and connect to a three-way valve to divert the water out to your landscape on a nice sunny day, or to send it to the sewer if it's snowing outside, or if, you know, you had a baby with dirty diapers, or any number of reasons, you know, bleach in the water, or, you know, bad soaps. You could always send that water back to sewer, but you know, you switch this simple valve and it sends it straight out to your landscape. We call these systems laundry to landscape. And you can build it yourself for, you know, a few hundred bucks. And it's really not that complicated. And I actually, on my website, coloradograywater.com, I've got a free PDF for people to download that shows you how to build these systems that would be to code. And so I encourage people to look at that online, figure out how to do these, and try it. And, you know, tell your local jurisdiction, hey, I'm going to try this, and I'd like it to be legal and permitted so that, you know, in the future you have the ability to sell your house or, you know, do other things that getting a building permit allow you to do.
Right, and that's what a great offering to be able to go on your website and download something that they could use to get this permit. That's really a great step.
And you put one of those gray water systems in for our laundry system, and it really helps. We have several fruit trees on the east side of our house, and plus all of the understory and midstory and hollyhocks, and it really greens that whole area up. Then we don't have to actually water it, so all those perennial things tap right into that. And then you also showed some videos. Bert Lancaster in Arizona has a great website on gray water that he's done in his urban situation there, and you might want to give the people a link to that.
Sure, yeah. Brad Lancaster is one of my teachers, and he literally wrote the book on harvesting rainwater, and hey, his website is harvestingrainwater.com. He's got lots of information, although he's in Arizona and their rules are slightly different than ours, but you know, I encourage you to go on, find the resources you need, build these systems, and we really need these laws to be adopted so that we can monitor how these systems are working and really encourage them and start to subsidize them. You know, here on the Front Range in Denver, they've adopted this law. They're one of the only jurisdictions that adopted this law, And we're working to subsidize these systems and make them even more affordable for homeowners, so that you can have a green landscape even during a drought year.
All of the, yeah, it's so much water within our houses that we're just kind of flushing down the toilet, and could be, especially in this time right now, we're on water restrictions and people are not to be irrigating their landscapes, or if they are, at a very limited rate, while all this water is still being used in the house and could be sent right outside.
Another thing that you teach in the class is roof catchment and all of the ways we can catch water off the roof and divert it into tanks or divert it directly into landscaping. We have just about all of our roofs connected to some sort of beneficial use, whether it goes into a greenhouse tank or whether it goes into tanks outside that we can water, or whether it goes into landscape. So we just put an overflow on one of our 5-gallon or 50-gallon tanks that goes in to water some grapes. You did that yesterday, I think, or a couple days ago.
That's right. Yeah. And so that's another law that was recently passed. One of the laws that I went down to the House of Representatives and testified and said, you know, this stuff really makes sense. And so we're now across the state without a permit, legally allowed to install 2 55-gallon barrels on each household to use for irrigation. And so it's a great step in the right direction. And so rain barrels are great. I also have links on my website for how to install rain barrels. But what I really advocate for is that our landscape is the largest and freest storage tank that we have. And if you were to dig a small basin in your landscape that would capture the water and allow it to sink into the ground, you could plant around that with trees and they could tap into that water a month or two after that rain event. And so rain barrels are great, but the landscape is even better, and there's never been anything illegal about pointing your downspout at your landscape.
And what a great opportunity right now. You know, we've been in this very long period without rain, and we've seen rain for the last 3 days or so, really beautiful, long, sometimes hard rain. And I'm hopeful that many of us, or some of us, have a landscape that's ready to catch that, so that the next month for us, if we don't get the rain, is still nice for our plants.
And Avery, the plumbing to do that is so simple, because all you're using is maybe 1.5 inch PVC pipe and some 5-gallon nursery flats and wood chips to spread that. Can you talk a little bit about how that goes in? Say if you had a bed next to your house and you wanted to, it would be far enough away from your foundation that you wouldn't, then talk about how you would install that.
Yeah, so, you know, like I said, rain gardens are really the best solution in any landscape. And they're very simple. You know, you can do it yourself with a shovel. You want to get the rainwater about 5 to 10 feet away from your home's foundation to make sure that no flooding happens in your basement. And so you can take a downspout pipe and bring it 5 feet away or 10 feet away, or you can dig a little diversion trench that brings the water away. But then once you're, you know, at that safe distance from your house, all you need to do is dig a basin that's maybe 6 inches deep. So we're not talking about like a pit in your landscape. We're just talking about a mellow depression, and something that would be like, you know, a 10-foot circle that's 6 inches deep could hold hundreds of gallons of water and allow it to percolate into the landscape. And then if you fill that with mulch, organic matter, that can hold on to 10 times its weight in water. So when we get these large rainstorms that come in surges, you know, that can be held in our landscape in the organic matter and in these basins, and our trees can tap into that water, you know, weeks, months later, without any storage, without rain barrels, without plumbing, without any complicated systems. So the landscape is really the best place to divert and harvest rainwater.
I'm going to jump right in there. You are listening to the Living Permaculture Show on KDNK. We are talking with Avery Ellis about water, among other things. I want to share one of my favorite quotes with everyone out there by Edward Abbey. Water, water, water. There is no shortage of water in the desert, but exactly the right amount. A perfect ratio of water to rock, water to sand, ensuring that wide, free, open, generous spacing among plants and animals, homes and towns and cities, which makes the arid West so different from any other part of the nation. There is no lack of water here, unless you try to establish a city where no city should be. I always liked that one, especially in a permaculture setting, thinking about usage of water and then also just appropriate usage of water. What are we trying to grow and where are we trying to grow it? And what strategies can we use to get us there? But then also, do we need lawns in the West? Does that make sense for us? Maybe, maybe not. What do you guys think?
Well, yeah, you go ahead, Jerome. You go ahead.
Well, you've been over Pat Hotchkiss and other places doing water catchment workshops for farmers who are running out of water. Their ditch is mm-hmm. dry. Maybe they have 10 acres, but they have a well. And they don't have enough water to water that, especially when there's no water even. They don't even have water rights to do that. But even the people who have water rights, the ditches are already dry. In the Arkansas, they're dried up. So there's a couple of different ways that we can do swaling to catch the water that comes in the spring and do perennial polycultures in those swales, but also add the gray water system and the roof catchments around mm-hmm. their house to so they can add an extra 1 acre of whatever they're going to plant. But you've been over to Paonia, Hotchkiss areas. Can you talk a little bit about what the farmers are up against?
Sure, yeah. So exactly what you're saying, Jerome, is right. You know, planting bluegrass lawns is not the best use of our space or our water. Perennials do much better in our climate with less resources. And so in Paonia, where I was just visiting, they've got orchards that are not necessarily oriented to capture water. You know, they're just sort of grids of orchard. And that was appropriate back when it was first developed, you know, in the early 1900s. But if you look at it now, if we were able to dig a trench that was level on the contour of the slope that went across the slope, whenever that water came down, it would be caught in that trench and spread all the way across to water an entire orchard that's, you know, 200 feet long or 1,000 feet long of each row. And so that's one approach for orchards. And the same is true even for ranchers. And I was speaking with a bunch of ranchers in Hotchkiss, and we talked about how they just have open prairie land. And, you know, if we did that same approach and dig a trench that's level on the contour of the slope and planted trees along that trench and then gave them a big stretch of grazing land before the next contour, you know, planting, their animals could graze in that grassland in between the trees. The trees are helping to retain moisture in the field. They're giving shade to the animals and actually increasing the yield on their animals and reducing the stress on these animals. So that's mm-hmm. a technique called silvopasture. And, you know, it integrates water harvesting with growing trees and raising animals all in one system. And it's said to be one of the best solutions for combating climate change right now. Those trees will sequester the CO2 that the animals are producing. They'll give them shade, and they'll increase your yields for your grazing animals.
And Mark Shepard was teaching a workshop doing swaling over in Hotchkiss last year. And he ran through that whole process over there. And that's one of, we took our design course back in the 90s. And there's other people actually that have equipment that are doing that. So in Hotchkiss, there are people already doing 40 acres of contour planting with permaculture swales and perennial polycultures with fruit trees. So there are people who can actually install those systems right now.
Absolutely. And yes. If you were to do that, you can send water straight into there and it sinks in to water those plants months after the ditches run dry.
Awesome. I just had I wanted to touch on these swales and berms just from the perspective of what we're dealing with locally and a lot of places around the country after these extreme fires. But in this region, these fires that have gone up these slopes that have quite a lot of elevation gain. And now we're looking at these rains that have come the past few days and the erosion and flood risk that those things create. I've heard a few people over the past month or so talk about swales and berms in this respect as well, not only from a water catchment and storage side, but also for a prevention of erosion and helping to repair these landscapes quicker. What are your feelings on that for both you guys, actually?
Well, we have... go ahead. We've been talking to the Forest Service about getting some straw retaining strips, and also we got a whole bunch of seed from Rivendell to reseed the Basalt Mountain area. We're waiting to hear back from the Forest Service. We had a meeting with them up on Basalt Mountain to start reclaiming some of those fragile areas up there around our watershed, where all of the mountain, a lot of the mountain people get their water, and it's very fragile. We just had that rain last night. It wasn't heavy enough, I don't think, that Roger and Jim, Ginger and Rob got their water system. They had to rebuild their water system after the fire, and they could also, it could just get flooded out again without doing that reclamation, without reseeding it, without doing some sort of contour catchments of some sort, whether it's laying down logs on the contour or putting in some kind of catchment strategies. And we've done it with wrapping bush bales of scrub oak together and staking them into the ground as sort of little check dams and catchments. There's all kinds of strategies, but you can buy the stuff off the shelf. So we're hoping to get that done before we have some major flooding down in Basalt as well. They've talked about doing the reclamation, but I haven't seen anything actually happening on the ground yet.
Yeah, Jerome, I really appreciate all the work you're doing to reclaim that forest up there. It's going to be a long, hard effort to bring life back up there. But for those who are listening that aren't very used to these disasters occurring, you know, this is a very common pattern for Colorado. Drought leading to fire, and that leading to flood. So, you know, you guys had this big fire up on the mountain in Basalt Mountain. And what happens is that the fire not only burns the plants, but it burns the soil. And in that respect, it leaves a waxy coating on top of the soil, which is actually more hydrophobic than it was ever before. So during these big rainstorms, these mountains start shedding more water than they ever were. So we really need to get in there pretty quickly and start doing some strategies to retain that moisture up on the hillside. And what Jerome was saying, you know, dropping those logs, those burned logs, it's basically biochar. If we were up there with some chainsaws and we could knock those trees down level across the slope, they would catch sediment, they would catch seed, they would catch water, and suddenly the revegetation process goes a lot faster than it would go just by throwing seed on a blank hillside.
And we did some of those at our forest garden workshop. What we do on 1 acre of my pinyon and juniper forest, and we've been doing it for years. You've been going up there with a laser and laying out swales under the pinyon and juniper, and we cut up the dead branches. And then we lay them out on the contour, dig a trench behind them, and then we reseed them. And that catches all of the water on our landscape, so none of the water leaves that whole acre, and we can reseed it. Now we're growing all kinds of fruit trees in there, and the wildflowers are coming back, and we have lots of ground covers and forage for the animals. I have... you know, for deer and the turkeys come in there and they forage a whole acre that you've soiled over the last 5 or 6 years.
That's right. And, you know, these strategies are not only as strategies for reclaiming the forest, they actually make it more resilient in the long run, right? When we look at, you know, dealing with disasters like fire, we talk about defensible space and clearing areas of forest. That doesn't make your home necessarily any more resistant to an ember blowing in the wind. What makes your home more resistant is water harvesting earthworks. When the land can be more relatively humid because of these earthworks and these plantings, you know, that builds resilience and that makes your space more resistant to these fires in the long run.
Awesome. Well, Avery, we have about 2 minutes left, so I'd love for you to share with our listeners, one, again, how to reach you and get more information about the work you do. But then I know you run a lot of courses up there on the Front Range, so if there's anything coming up that might be available for more people to sign up for, if you wanted to share that, this would be a great time.
Sure. Well, Stephanie, I really appreciate you having me on the show, as always. Mm-hmm. You can find me at coloradograywater.com if they want to learn about graywater systems or rainwater harvesting systems. People can also find me at boulderpermaculture.com, where we host the yearly permaculture design course. We also host a series of workshops, and we have about four of them remaining for this year. Things from natural building to making medicine from nature to gray water systems. So if you guys want to get more involved and you're down on the Front Range, you can find me there. Otherwise, I'm looking forward to coming back next summer to help you guys continue the restoration projects on the mountain and to continue building resilience up at the Permaculture Institute.
Yeah, and at Crimpy, we have some workshops coming up in September and October, so get a hold of us at crmpi.org for a one-day workshop on forest garden and greenhouse.
Thanks for tuning in to Katie and Kay. This was the Living Permaculture Show, every fourth Wednesday of the month, and we will see you in September.